the bruised reed and smoldering wick, exposition of Matthew 12:20 in view of Isaiah 42:3 by Robert C. Newman. In Matthew 13:52, Jesus gives us the parable of the householder bringing out things old and new. It goes like this. He said to them, "Therefore every teacher of the law who has been instructed about the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who brings out of his storeroom new treasures as well as old." It's a picture here of a teacher of the law instructed in the kingdom, scribe of the kingdom, I think is actually the Greek there, is pictured as like a householder who has presumably got guests or something, and he's showing off his heirlooms and his new treasures, if you like. So brings them out and shows them, etc., to the impress his guests and that sort of thing. And basically, I think the picture here is that we as Jesus followers, or at least those of us who are Bible teachers, but every Christian should be a Bible teacher at some level, that we are to be continually learning from Scripture. So that we have material which we've known for a long time, and we continue to use that, and we have new things that we have learned, and we begin to use that as well. So that's basically the picture here. This talk, The Bruised Reed and the Smoldering Wick, is a sample from my own experience of this particular kind of thing. I was preparing a sermon to preach in chapel at Biblical Seminary back in 1984, and I planned to preach on one topic, but then found that the passage I'd chosen was really about something else. And I suppose I could have gone to find another a passage that really was about the topic I'd planned to preach on, but I figured, well, this is the Lord's provision, so I changed the subject to my sermon instead and preached on the same passage, but tried to preach on what it now appeared to be about. Well, we're looking at Matthew 12:20. What is the meaning of Matthew 12:20? We want to look first at the passage in its context, Matthew 12:15-21. Reading from the NIV, aware of this opposition to the Pharisees that was developing, Jesus withdrew from that place. Many followed him, and he healed all their sick, warning them not to tell who he was. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. "Here is my servant, whom I have chosen, the one I love and whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him. He will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out, till he leads justice to victory. In his name the nations will put their hope." And the last few verses there from 18 to 21 are a quotation of Isaiah 42:1-4. If we think about this passage, Matthew 12:20, in its context, the larger context here, starting before the passage we read, is the growing opposition to Jesus. Jesus gives his warning to unrepentant cities in Matthew 11:20-24, and then speaks to his father in prayer of the things that have been hidden from the wise and revealed to babies in verses 25 through 30 of chapter 11. And then in the first 14 verses of chapter 12, we have a couple of Sabbath controversies, which end with the Pharisees plotting on how to kill Jesus. So very serious opposition developed. So Jesus withdraws, so this is the beginning of our passage, and while continuing to heal, discourages publicity. Now Matthew here in our passage is quoting Isaiah 42:3 as fulfilled in Jesus, and it's actually Isaiah 42:1-4, but we're concerned about this verse 3 primarily. I initially thought that the reference to the bruised reed that he won't break and the smoldering wick that he won't snuff out meant that Jesus would not crush the weak. And this is certainly a biblical truth and a good sermon topic. Compare Isaiah 40:11, where the prophet says, "He tends his flock like a shepherd. He gathers the lambs in his arms and carries them close to his heart and gently leads those that have young." But if you examine the figurative use of the two images in our verse, the bruised reed and the smoldering wick, and we're going to look after what we can find in the Bible on that. So it turns out we find a reed staff, so a reed that would be used as kind of a walking stick, we might say, and a wick, or a reference to smoldering in general. We find that these images suggest it's the wicked that are in view, not the weak. Let's have a look. Reed staff, Isaiah 36:6. All of these are in the NIV. Look now, you who are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it, such as Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend upon him. So the prophet Isaiah is warning the Israelites, or the rulers anyway, that it is foolish to depend upon Egypt for your protection, because it's like a splintered reed of a staff, kind of like a bruised reed, if you like, and it won't hold you up, it won't support you, it will break and damage you. Huh? Ezekiel 29:6 and 7, then all who live in Egypt will know that I am the Lord. You have been a staff, he's talking to Egypt, you have been a staff of reed for the house of Israel. When they grasped you with your with their hands, you splintered, and you tore open their shoulders. When they leaned on you, you broke, and their backs were wrenched. So Israel injured from depending upon Egypt for their protection. And they're pictured again as a reed staff which wouldn't support them. 2 Kings 18:21. Look now, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it, such as Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend upon him. So it gets this picture of a weakness, not able to support the weight put upon it, and so foolish to depend upon it. But on the other hand, there's also an idea of wickedness in a Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and the Egyptians as the protection for Israel instead of depending upon God. The wicked smoldering passages look like this, again out of Isaiah 43:17, so not far from our passage. The Lord who drew out the chariots and horses, the army and reinforcements together, and they lay there, never to rise again, extinguished, snuffed out like a wick. So God's bringing disaster upon these armies. Proverbs 13:9, the light of the righteous shines brightly, but the lamp of the wicked is snuffed out. Very explicitly, the wicked, and a contrast between the light of the righteous and the lamp of the wicked. Isaiah 7:4, where Isaiah is speaking to King Ahaz, say to him, be careful, keep calm, and don't be afraid. Do not lose heart because of these two smoldering stubs of firewood, because of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Okay, so don't worry about these two enemies, the northern kingdom and the Arameans, who are threatening to attack Judah and depose its king and such, but trust God. And these two nations are pictured as smoldering stubs of firewood, so smoldering wick, etc. So those things seem to point to the wicked rather than the weak, although perhaps both ideas are there as well. Also, the context in Matthew suggests the wicked are in view rather than the weak. In Matthew 12:20b, we have the remark about crushing, that Jesus won't crush these enemies until he leads justice to victory, suggests that he might crush them at that time, but won't before then. And then in 12:17, where Matthew refers to Jesus being the fulfillment of this Isaiah passage, there's a connection to the Isaiah quotation, 43:1-4, with verses 15 and 16, where Jesus withdraws from those plotting to kill him and damps down the publicity about his activities, trying to discourage the crowds from doing too much spreading around, particularly who he is. Huh? So what we see here is that Jesus leaves his opponents room to respond, not forcing their hands before his hour has come. If we look at the context in Isaiah, this also fits what we suggested, though here it's somewhat more ambiguous. The Isaiah context emphasizes the servant as one who brings justice to the nations. See that in verses 1, 3, and 4. And that normally implies judicial or military action against the wicked. But the servant's procedure is unusual. He's not shouting, nor raising his voice in the streets. He's not breaking the bruised reed or snuffing the smoldering wick. So a picture seems to be that he is not using what we might think of as violent methods. So my suggestion is that both these passages, the Isaiah 43 passage and the Matthew 11 passage, it is, look at Jesus' redemptive work. But the till clause there gives a hint that he will not use force until the second coming. We'll not crush the bruised reed or snuff the smoldering wick until, etc. This is, in fact, characteristic of Jesus' ministry while he was on earth here, and is at least as important as the other suggestion of not crushing the weak. Take some examples. For instance, Paul. God could have stopped Paul on the way to Damascus in Acts 9 by crushing him. God did something like that to Pharaoh and his armies at the Red Sea. He did something like that to the troops coming to arrest Elijah. You remember the groups of 50 that the king had sent out in 2 Kings 1. And up to a third one where the leader of that group begs for mercy, God sends fire down from heaven to destroy the other two troops. Huh? Instead, he redeems Paul so that Paul becomes one of his servants. Another example, Jesus rebukes James and John when they want to call down fire from heaven on the inhospitable Samaritans in Luke 9, 51-56. Jesus won't do it. Jesus stops Peter from fighting when the soldiers come to arrest him in Matthew 26 and parallels. So we see there are good examples of Jesus refusing to use force to advance his program, if you like. Well, the question then is, what's the application here for us? Well, think about God's agenda. As God's servants, we are to be little models of Christ. We're to imitate him in many ways. Well, as such, our agenda is to be God's agenda. Remember how Jesus speaks that he didn't come to do his will, he came to do his Father's will, etc. Well, we've got that same kind of responsibility. Well, in this age, God's agenda is the work of redemption. At least that's the agenda that he's assigned to his followers, to the church. So, we are bringing justice, not by demanding our rights, not by using violence to right wrongs and that sort of thing. There's a place for that, but the place for that is not the church's place. The place for that is the state's place. I discuss some of these things in other PowerPoint talks we have. I think one of them is the church and the state, and the other one, I think, is about warfare. You'll have to look at the exact title on that one. We're bringing justice not by demanding our rights, but by giving up our rights in such a way that wicked people may be redeemed. So this is the rationale between Jesus' commands in Matthew 5, 38-48, which otherwise seems so unrealistic. That is, that we're to turn the other cheek. We're to give someone who wants our tunic, our cloak also. We're to go the second mile. We're to love our enemies. We're to pray for our persecutors. Let's have a look at that passage. You have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, says Jesus, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you. Do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Let's skip over a little bit of verse there to get this on the page. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. So, we've been called to model Jesus, and here, reading this passage out of Matthew I've just read, I suggest that may we, like Jesus, not crush the bruised reed or snuff out the smoldering wick. We have a responsibility to put up with mistreatment in order that people might be saved. So that's really the end of my talk here. You can go and think back through that passage, but my plea is that we might be little samples of Jesus in turning the other cheek and going the second mile. May the Lord help us to do that. Thank you for your attention.